is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name is Stephen Schubert. You are listening to the Country Hour. I'm filling in for Matt Brand for just today. Well, the global demand for Kakadu plums has been a genuine success story for Indigenous communities across the Top End which harvest them. But one Aboriginal organisation says it needs to negotiate every year with the Land Council to access the crop, and that's even if it's traditional owners working on their own land.
It's actually easier for non-Aboriginal businesses to actually enter into Kakadu plum harvesting off parks and wildlife lands than it is for traditional owners to actually harvest off their traditional homelands.
And a bit later today, we will hear about a new breed of banana that scientists say is pretty well immune from Tropical Race 4. Could it mean a resurgence of the territory's banana industry? All that and plenty more coming up on the Country Hour. But we start today with Australia's largest exporter of corals and exotic fish species, which has just been named the 2021 Australian Exporter of the Year. From humble beginnings in the Darwin suburb of Moyle in 2008, Monsoon Aquatics now runs operations in Darwin, Cairns and Bundaberg and is now regarded as the country's best exporter. Matt Brand spoke to Dan Kimberley from Monsoon Aquatics.
Yeah, g'day. I'm Daniel Kimberley, the director of Monsoon Aquatics.
Hey, well done. Australian Exporter of the Year. Tell us a bit about last night.
Oh, mate, it was great. Surprising. Yeah, there was a really strong field of contestants in there who won their respective sectors. So we won the agribusiness sector, obviously for the Northern Territory, and then we went on to win it nationally. And then to our surprise at the end, we were awarded the overall Exporter of the Year, which was huge. Yeah, it was great.
So are you able to give our audience a bit of a snapshot of your business when it comes to exports?
Yeah, so we're licensed collectors of live coral and fish. We've got operations in the Northern Territory, which is where we started 14 years ago. And we've got one in Cairns and one in Bundaberg. And we harvest coral sustainably from the oceans under permits. And we then process that, we grow it out in-house and export it all around the world.
And as for 2021, how has business been in a world where, you know, there's so many freight issues?
Bloody nightmare, to put it bluntly. It's been difficult. You nailed it on the head. Like, the demand is there for our product. And if anything, COVID probably increased it because I guess people were stuck at home, you know, wanting to spend their money on something. Pet shops and aquarium stores were usually still open. So we did see probably a spike in demand, but getting it there was the big problem. We rely on air freight, and that air freight is passenger planes. So obviously it's been really, really difficult.
You've sort of relied heavily on that federal government IFAM project, haven't you? The International Freight Assistance Mechanism.
Yeah, look, that definitely helped, and especially out of Darwin, the freighter planes leaving out of Darwin were a great assistance for us, definitely.
The business traditionally was all about catching special corals and fish species from the wild, but you do a lot now in the aquaculture space. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, at the core, we're a commercial fishing business. And, you know, we have for years now sustainably harvested fish and coral from everywhere, from Broome all the way down to Bundaberg, including Northern Territory. But now, for the past sort of 4 years, we've been increasingly investing back into aquaculture programs. And we were lucky enough to win a dollar-for-dollar federal government grant, the Accelerating Commercialization Grant, recently. And that's really helped us invest more into our aquaculture program. And really excitingly, we've spawned a couple of species of coral recently that are endemic to Australia, and it's kind of like a world first to do it. So we're well on our way to commercializing that coral spawning and aquaculture side of the company. But realistically, it's quite a few years off. It's I think, as I said last night in the awards, it's a mixture of magic and science. There's nothing known about it. So we're really having to do a lot of guesswork based on what, you know, we know now. So it's going to be a long process, but it's really exciting.
Are you able to give us a little sense of what's involved in getting coral to spawn indoors?
Well, look, at the moment, it's really, we're still relying on natural cues. So the corals are still spawning when they would naturally spawn on the reef. So we kind of, a little bit of guesswork. We generally know when the main coral spawning is going to happen, but the species we're working with are generally not known when they actually spawn. So a little bit of guesswork there, and it's basically every single night from sort of 4:30 in the afternoon to 10 p.m., we've got someone watching the corals. And then as soon as they start to release an egg or two, you know, we know that it's going to start ramping up, and then they'll peak probably a couple of days after that and then start ramping down. So basically it's a lot of man hours. It's a lot of staff hours watching and waiting.
You can't pretend to be the moon and kick things into gear?
Not yet, but that's the plan. So, yeah, once we have established, I guess, some baseline knowledge around how, when they spawn, how to grow the young, you know, to a commercial size, then we need to look at cues and conditioning to get them to spawn out of season when we want to during business hours would be ideal.
Obviously, you're a commercial business, but the technology you're talking about, what could it mean for conservation in Australia?
Oh, huge, mate. It's like, I guess, it's pretty well known now that you can propagate coral. So you can cut it up and you know, replant it, and it will grow. The spawning side of it, instead of producing 10 or 20 pieces of coral from one, you can hopefully produce thousands. So it's probably like trying to seed your paddock with runners versus seed. You know, you're going to get a lot more bang for your buck if you can, you know, reproduce things by seed or by spawning. So long term, we really want to use what we learn to be involved in future habitat restoration and reef restoration.
Have you got any contracts in that space already?
No, there's not anything actively happening from a commercial point of view yet. So we're building the capability, and I feel that when the government's ready to do this on a large scale, it will be tendered out to commercial businesses, and operators like us will sort of be at the front there, ready to go.
An interesting business, an award-winning business. Well done, and thanks so much for your time on the Country Hour.
Thanks, Matt.
That is Dan Kimberley from Monsoon Aquatics speaking there to Matt Brand. How's that? Not just the best exporter in the territory, the best exporter right across Australia. So, Dan, from the Country Hour, congratulations.
G'day guys, I'm Billy. I'm a trap fisherman here in the Northern Territory, and we're today unloading our catch from the last 2 weeks fishing out in the Kimberleys, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Well, harvesting the native Kakadu plum has been an absolute success story for Indigenous communities across Northern Australia. It's used in health and cosmetic products right around the world. The industry, though, says it still has plenty of room to grow. But agreements to harvest the fruit on Indigenous-owned land are done year by year. I spoke to North Australia Aboriginal Kakadu Plum Alliance Executive Office Paul Sakey and the water-based Tamara Development Corporation CEO Scott McIntyre, who want to see 5 or 10 year agreements for land use. Scott says right now traditional owners who want to commercially harvest Kakadu plums on their own land still need the permission from the Land Council to do so.
Where you have that not well understood locally, that can cause some concerns, because traditional owners will equate their ownership to the right to undertake activities that they see fit on their country, which to a large extent under the Land Rights Act, that's true. It's when it becomes commercial and you introduce enterprises to that situation or to that picture that it becomes more complex. So for a traditional owner to go out hunting customary activities on country, they don't need anyone else's permission. They can go and do it. But the minute you start to step into the commercial or business landscape, you've got other factors that you've got to satisfy.
What is the potential for this industry if you can negotiate longer term access to the land?
The Kakadu plum industry is an emerging industry. In 2019, the estimated farm gate value of the sector was about 1.6 million, and that's forecast to grow to 3.6 million by 2025. Now, in order for that growth to continue to accelerate and continue, a lot of harvesters, such as the harvesters in Wat Aer, do require some sort of certainty, some sort of tenure in terms of their commercial activities in relation to Kakadu plum harvesting. So I guess having these types of agreements are really important to ensure that these enterprises continue to grow.
And Scott, what's the potential for the local industry in Wat Aer?
Locally, this last harvest season, this calendar year, we harvested about 12 tonnes of plum, of raw product, that's wild harvested, about $170,000 worth of money to local pickers in their pockets for direct impact for harvesting, and employment of, I think it was 8 local women employed in that process on the ground locally. And we really think that that's a large proportion of the overall national harvest. So I think it's over half of the national harvest that we're providing on that annual basis at the moment. But really, it's a drop in the ocean for what's out there. And, you know, we've got the potential, if we have greater certainty and if we can properly create this as a known, understood, harvestable commodity, who knows what tonnage we'll get, which equates to further dollars locally, which equates to further jobs, which has all sorts of flow-on effects locally. Broader than that, I guess, Paul, like the potential from even globally, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, so according to our understanding of this sector and inquiries that we get, certainly the demand for Kakadu plum far outstrips supply. We do know there's a number of other Indigenous communities that are really keen to actually start harvesting as well. And of course, they're facing this exact same challenge. Under the current model, it's actually easier for non-Aboriginal businesses to actually enter into Kakadu plum harvesting off parks and wildlife lands than it is for traditional owners to actually harvest off their traditional homelands. So it's a little bit of a strange sort of situation to be in.
So you've approached the Northern Land Council asking to open negotiations to sort this issue out. You've shown me a letter dated from October last year to the NLC. What's the response been?
Well, we haven't actually heard back on since that letter was sent, but to be fair to the Land Council, we haven't exactly followed it up like bulls at a gate either. So it goes back to what I was saying before. I think like it's organisational capacity stuff. You know, we've got to be up and ready and pushing and progressing. Nothing will come easily and nothing will come for free. And I guess it's symbolic, I think, of the Land Council are a large organisation. They have a lot on their plate. It's understandable that nothing like this will necessarily move really quickly. I guess the opportunity is to collectively understand what this industry is potentially becoming, and for us to work together and shining a light and resourcing where it needs to be so that we can together push it forward, because it's not insurmountable. I mean, the Land Rights Act is strong, is good. It has mechanisms to enable this very thing. You know, we've all got to be up and capable to execute that and make it work.
How much of a handbrake is it going to be if you don't get longer-term land access agreements?
It's a fair handbrake. I mean, we're not the first people to be trying to do this, and we're not the first people to be trying to develop an economic opportunity on Aboriginal land. The risk is that whilst there's momentum and capability around and drive and passion from the traditional owners to see it occur, that can diminish over time if we don't start to see real progress.
Sorry, I'd just like to add that one of the things that NACP is actually really concerned about is Indigenous participation in the Australian native food sector. So recent surveys have indicated that of the 13 major bush foods that are currently being produced and sold domestically and internationally, less than 15% of those producers are actually Indigenous. So our concern is that we really want to keep Indigenous involvement in this sector alive moving into the future, and so we want to try and remove as many barriers to that as possible.
On yesterday's Country Hour, we heard from a NT government researcher looking into what is the ideal soil type for Kakadu plum. Do you think we could one day see this amazing natural resource being cultivated in the top end?
Yeah, absolutely. More and more, the work we're doing is outward looking, in the sense that we're looking at research partners, we're looking at external enabling organisations to help understand in a contemporary sense the stuff that's on the ground. In a place like Wadeye, we've got the unique opportunity as well to draw from the traditional understanding of propagation and harvesting. And there's the landscape littered with it's a supermarket out there. You know, people know where stuff grows and people know what works and what doesn't work. So the opportunity we've got is to create a bit of a hybrid where it's, you know, drawing from the old two toolboxes, you know, the Indigenous toolbox of what's on country, what's good and what's not, mixed in with a contemporary toolbox of commercialization and respectful development. I mean, it is a realistic proposition, absolutely.
That's Tamara Development Corporation CEO Scott McIntyre and Northern Australia Aboriginal Kakadu Plum Executive Officer Paul Sakey. And the Country Hour has asked the Northern Land Council for a response. In a statement, the NLC has confirmed it did receive correspondence from TDC on the 20th of October last year in 2020. The letter states that TDC and other organisations will prepare a proposal for the Northern Land Council to consider. The Land Council says it received a land use proposal a bit more than a year later, the 15th of November this year. So just, 11 days ago. That was a proposal for a 10-year licence to harvest Kakadu plum, the Land Council says. And it says this proposal will be considered by the NLC and presented to relevant traditional Aboriginal owner groups early next year. We will keep you up to date on the Country Hour. I've had a text from Charlie in Catherine, sending his congratulations to Dan Kimberley and the team from Monsoon Aquatics. Charlie says, what a great story from Monsoon Aqua. Local business from little to big to the bigger picture, and even ahead of governments by the sound of it, so well done. Well, Charlie, I'm sure that means a lot. Dan Kimberley and Monsoon Aquatics, the best exporter in the country. And Charlie, I hope you're keeping well and Catherine in the lockdown there. We will be getting the latest on the COVID situation a little bit after the 1 o'clock news. Right now, though, let's just have an absolute classic from Troy Cassadaly. An absolute favourite here at the Country Hour, Troy Cassadaly. He is in line for an absolute swag of golden guitars at the Tamworth Country Music Festival. I think earlier this week we said he had won 37 golden guitars, something like that. Just an absolute champion of the Australian country music scene. Well, scientists say they're getting ready to team up with farmers to trial a variety of banana that's resistant to Panama disease tropical race 4. That's the disease that wiped out the territory's banana industry in the 90s. And since then, a lot of new research into this new tolerant breed of banana has happened here, right here in the NT. Tom Major spoke to Queensland University of Technology Professor James Dale.
We had an initial small field trial that started in 2012 and finished in 2015, so over 3 years. We then had a bit of a hiatus because there was a period we couldn't grow bananas in the Northern Territory due to another disease called freckle. We then replanted a much, much larger field trial in 2018, so it's now just on 3.5 years in the field. And the results are really a mirror image of what we got in the first trial. So we've got one line which is exceptionally good. So it's a Cavendish line that is pretty close to immune to Tropical Race 4.
Do you have any idea when we could see some results from these trials or when the trials could be taken to a wider scale?
That's what we're planning right at the moment. COVID-19 has put quite a few roadblocks in our way. Just for us getting up and down to the Northern Territory has been difficult. We are planning on location field trials in other countries. I can't say which ones at the present time, but that's in the pipeline, and that may well start to occur in 2022. So we're just in a number of discussions around organising those. Those plants, the one particular line, is just about ready to go for deregulation, and we're putting together all of the data around deregulating that line initially here.
And of course, disease resistance is one thing. What about yield? Have you got any results on the yield of this new resistant strain?
Yes, we do. I can't say a lot about that yet because we're a little bit constrained by confidentiality. However, I can say that you could probably grow this line and you would be very, very happy with the results.
James Dale, he's the Banana Research Program Leader at QUT based in Brisbane with an update on the hunt for a disease-resistant banana. And I wonder if that could make bananas more appealing for top-end farmers. Well, you are listening to the Country Hour. It's 4 minutes to 1 o'clock. Let's head to Tennant Creek before the 1 o'clock news, where the company behind the plans to build one of the largest solar farms in the world, right here in the Territory, is forging ahead with construction plans. Suncable has been looking to keep employment in the NT and has contracted a number of local Tennant Creek businesses. Hugo Rickard-Bell caught up with Chris Civitarese, who's the senior manager for T&J Construction. He says it's great news for the town.
T&J are a trade services company, so basically electrical, refrigeration, building maintenance and construction works.
You're going to be helping out on the Suncable project. What are you going to be doing for them?
Well, at the moment, we're doing work on some of their development sites. So we're doing electrical hookups and connections around their pilot plants, just so Suncable can conduct some of their environmental tests.
Once it starts, they start putting the panels in and that sort of thing, what will you be doing for them?
As I said, we're doing some of the hookups now. They're doing a couple of hundred solar panels at the moment for these tests. It's just for some of their environmental studies, so they can get all the approvals and everything in place, and then hopefully we can pick up some more work as it goes into the proper construction phase.
And Chris, what's this mean for T&J and Tennant Creek?
Oh, look, it's an exciting time for us. It's to be involved in a project like this. There's not many opportunities to be involved in a renewable energy project of this size, so it's pretty exciting. It's exciting for the Northern Territory and Tennant Creek because I think they're talking about 1,500 jobs during the construction phase and 350 operational jobs. So, yeah, I think it's exciting times for us.
How long will this project be up and running for T&J?
I'll look at the moment, the works we're doing are probably just leading into the wet at the moment, just to get these test sites up, and then we'll have to see where it goes after that. But we're making some good contacts, and there's going to be plenty of opportunities for local businesses, so we'll see what happens.
You mentioned it's going to provide a lot of jobs for the area. Is it going to provide more jobs for T&J?
Oh, 100%. If we can be involved in the construction phase, there'll be a lot more jobs here, a lot of education and training for local people.
Suncable's a massive operation. Tennant Creek's quite a small town. Does Tennant Creek, in your opinion, have the resources to sort of complete the whole project?
Oh, look, we probably do for the parts that are in this area. Tennant Creek and the local businesses have a history of scaling up and down for various projects, so I don't think you'll find any issues with capacity to do the local works.
So Suncable is good news for the area?
100%. We're looking forward to continuing to do work with them.
Chris Civitarese, who's the Senior Manager for T&J Construction. You're listening to the Country Hour, coming up to the 1 o'clock news in just a bit over a minute.
ABC Sport. Get ready for Grandstand Summer of Cricket on the ABC Listen app. Every ball.
It's bowled. Second ball.
Every catch.
Inches and he's caught. every wicket.
And he swings into this, he's got it covered.
Live and ad-free.
He launches him this time, pokes him all the way out of the ground.
All the action of Grandstand Summer of Cricket, live on the ABC Listen app.
And some big news coming from the Australian cricket team today. Fast bowler Pat Cummins has been appointed the captain of the men's team to replace Tim Payne. Batter Steve Smith has been appointed vice-captain, and Cummins is the first fast bowler to captain an Australian test side since 1956. So, first series, home Ashes series, no pressure, Pat.
Hello, my name is Beatrice and I'm from Wadaya.
Hello, my name is Stephanie Berda and I'm from Wadaya.
Hello, my name is Eugenie Gilbert. I'm from Wadaya.
And you're listening to Country Hour.
Almost time for the 1 o'clock news, but after that we will head south where the rain is falling at the worst possible time for people trying to get their grain crops in. Those crops absolutely smashed, millions of dollars of value wiped out. That and plenty more coming up. Right now it is time for the 1 o'clock news.
G'day guys, I'm Billy. I'm a trap fisherman here in the Northern Territory, and we're today unloading our catch from the last 2 weeks fishing out in the Kimberleys, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
G'day, Stephen Schubert filling in for Matt Brand on the Country Hour today. We'll get the latest from the Weather Bureau in a tick. Some big storms around the top end yesterday, actually causing some havoc with COVID-19 tests from Catherine. We'll get the latest on the COVID situation too. And we will be heading south to parts of the country that were just about to start harvesting a bumper grain crop until the rain started. It's become a heartbreaking season for farmers down in that part of Australia. And we'll also meet some station owners in Central Australia who are expanding their business, buying up the cattle property next door.
For stations to come up, neighbouring is not very, it doesn't happen very often, so we kind of, we weren't ready to make that decision, but we knew that this kind of opportunity might not come up again, so we had to...
We had to jump on it.
Plenty to come on the Country Hour, stick around. Were you under one of those absolutely enormous thunderstorms between Darwin and Catherine yesterday? Some really, really good rainfall around in the 24 hours to 9 o'clock and even since. To get the latest, let's have a chat to Angeline Prasad at the Weather Bureau. Hello, Angeline.
Hi there, Steve.
Now, some of these falls are over 100 mils in at least one place. What can you tell me?
Yeah, so Majestic Orchids has come in with 118 millimetres till 9 a.m. So that's 118. Other notable totals over the Daly District were Adelaide River 66.4, Beebom Crossing 54, La Belle 52, Port Keats has come in with 47. Out in the Carpentaria, we had one or two heavy falls there as well. MacArthur River 50.5 and Borroloola came in with 42 millimetres, Nuka 41. So there were heavier falls in the Arnhem and the Carpentaria, but the heaviest falls were concentrated over the Daly District. And today we've seen early thunderstorms fire up again over the southwest Daly and more so over the Arnhem and Groote Island. This morning, so Groote Island has already clocked 66 millimetres since 9 a.m.
Not bad, not bad.
Yes. So it's a slow start to the day for the Daly because of those massive thunderstorms yesterday. So it was a quiet morning, but we do expect the thunderstorm activity to pick up this afternoon and overnight. A trough has moved into the top end from down south. So that will help trigger more thunderstorm activity over the next couple of days.
So it sounds like we should be keeping our eyes peeled for severe weather warnings from the Bureau.
Yes. So today, heavy falls are likely again across the northern parts of the Daly and also the Arnhem District. So most likely these thunderstorms will produce heavy falls. So it is possible that we could issue warnings later in the day.
Looking a bit further ahead, what can you tell us? Is there going to be rainfall heading into the weekend next week?
So there is a drier southeasterly flow following this trough. In fact, this drier southeasterly flow has brought some glorious temperatures to Central Australia, with temperatures about 4 to 6 degrees below the average for the month of November. So some beautiful temperatures down there, very mild nights, and even daytime temperatures have generally been in the high 20s. This dry southeasterly flow will extend into the southern top end tomorrow and then potentially to the north coast on Sunday. So we do see a couple of dry days. However, showers and thunderstorms will continue across the coastal areas into next week and increase again, especially through the second half of next week. Now, the good thing about this thunderstorm, Steve, is they actually broke down the heat wave that we've been experiencing over the last couple of weeks.
Yes.
So once the thunderstorms clear on Sunday and Monday, we will see very hot temperatures return, unfortunately. So initially it will be over the western Gregory district, and then this heat will spread into Central Australia and into the southern parts of the top end
right.
for pretty much of next week. So that's another thing to contend next week. The very hot temperatures will be returning, unfortunately.
So, Ange, I normally live in Alice Springs and I'm up in Darwin at the moment for the last 2 weeks helping out at the Country Hour. So I've come up for a heat wave in the top end, missing out on that beautiful Central Australian weather. And now you're telling me when I fly back to Alice Springs, I'm there just in time for a Central Australian heat wave.
Well, unfortunately, we are forecasting temperatures to get to close to 40 on Friday. So the good thing about, I suppose, you know, it's not really a good thing, but it looks like it'll develop more as a low intensity heat wave, because the overnight temperatures are still quite good. The last 2 weeks we saw temperatures get up to 28, 29 degrees in some places overnight, so didn't really fall below 28, 29. If you look at our forecast temperatures over the next 7 days, there's only a gradual rise in the overnight temperature. So Tennant Creek is a good example. Last night, Tennant Creek got down to 23. We're forecasting about 22, 23s for the next few days. And then it does start to climb up, but it's a gradual climb up. So getting up to 25 on Wednesday, then 27 on Thursday. So it's really the end of next week where we'll see very hot days, but also the overnight temperatures will, you know, become a bit uncomfortable. So so there is time to prepare for this next heat wave. It doesn't really fester until the end of next week. So I hope you're not moving back to Alice Springs end of next week.
No, well, I will be there for that. But I think the centre's had a pretty good run of it for November. So probably they're probably due for a few 40-degree days.
Yes, it's been fabulous through Central Australia. Your average, Alice Springs average is 34 for the month of November. And we're forecasting temperatures in the high 20s. It's just fabulous.
It is indeed. Well, Angeline, thank you very much for the update.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That is Angeline Prasad at the Bureau of Meteorology for us.
G'day, I'm Harry Lawton. I'm a bullfighter here at Catherine Show Rodeo. You're listening to the Country Hour.
Still lots to come on the Country Hour. We will bring you the latest COVID update in a tick. And we'll also head down to a cattle station right on the South Australian border. Well, if you've looked at the TV in the last few days, you've no doubt seen the heavy rain and flooding going on in New South Wales. Matt Brand, who I thought was out fishing or something today, he's just snuck into the studio. Matt, you've been taking a look at this for Landline on this Sunday. What can you tell me?
Yeah, well, it's not looking good there in eastern parts of Australia. Remember that beautiful rain that went through Central Australia a few weeks ago? 100 millimetres at Alice Springs?
Yeah.
I mean, that system moved east and gave parts of Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria a big drenching then, which pulled up a lot of people from doing their harvest. It's been fairly stop-start since then. But this latest weather event, and there's more rain forecast for next week, is really causing problems. Just a moment ago, I had a chat to Mark Martin. He is a commodity advisor. He's based in the little country town of Murundi. His local creek is in flood. He's got his finger on the pulse. I got him to summarise just how things are looking at the moment in terms of the cropping country in New South Wales. This is what he said.
Look, up until midway through this week, it wasn't too bad. When I say not too bad, we've got the northern part of the state is over 50% harvested, and it was more storm activity, isolated incidents where there was some serious damage. And then as we moved further south, the early crops were still being ripped off, and the water was, again, it wasn't too bad. The last 30 hours, though, we've seen so much additional water that we've got the complication now of a number of the water storages spilling over, and this is going to, in the next 5 or 6 days, that water moving west and covering country and covering areas where there's crops still standing. And I think that's where we're probably going to see some of the material damage that we weren't looking at earlier this week.
So that's Mark Martin from Market Ag. Things are not looking good, especially in New South Wales. And this rain event is now having a very sharp impact on Australian grain prices. Here's Mark again.
Well, it's certainly pushing prices higher. If we look at the ASX wheat futures, only 2 weeks ago, they were sitting at around 350. They're 420 today. And it's the standard grades that are pushing up hard because they're the ones that are being impacted. APW is $420 port. And what we are seeing, though, is that the feed grades or the lower grades are shrinking. And so we had 2 or 3 weeks ago, we had a spread of about $70 between APW and feed wheat. It's $170 today. And the expectation is that they could easily go out to $200. And it's a factor of both the standard grade going up and the lower grade going down.
Yeah, so that's Mark Martin. He's a commodity advisor, and it's incredible to see what some of these grain prices are now doing because of the rain damage. And not just domestic prices, Steve, but also international grain markets. The world was kind of looking to Australia to save the day because this year we've seen awful drought in the Northern Hemisphere. Canada had a shocking crop. Russia keeps putting taxes on its commodities to try and keep as many within Russia as possible to reduce prices. So all eyes were on Australia. We were sitting on a bumper crop. So many of our Aussie farmers had the most ideal conditions leading up to harvest. And then sadly, at this last critical point, the November rain has arrived and it's kept on coming. Mark Martin, he believes that this rain in the east has put another $30 to $40 on premium wheat prices around the world. It's quite rare that Australia influences global grain markets in such a big way, but that's what we're seeing at the moment. If you're in the cattle industry, keep an eye on things because a lot of crop is going to get downgraded, which means the price of feed wheat is going to come right down. So for those in the feedlotting system, cheap grain on its way.
Well, there's always a silver lining for someone, I suppose. But I was actually just chatting to a family friend down where I grew up in Parkes in central west New South Wales this week. They've sold their farm now, but the whole district there is just absolutely heartbroken. So what can you do? It's
a tough one. There was a record 23 million hectares sown to winter crop in Australia this year. I haven't heard anyone yet make a bold prediction on just how much has been lost. I haven't heard any numbers yet, but certainly the amount of crop to be downgraded set to be significant. Anyway, you can catch more on Landline, Steve.
I'll get the plug in, Matt.
12:30, good show.
And will you be back on the radio on Monday, or are you off fishing or something?
No, even though you are doing a splendid job, Steve.
Thank you. That is Matt Brown. You can catch him on your telly on Landline on Sunday.
G'day, it's Brent Murdoch. I'm the Director and General Manager of Vista Gold. I look after the Mount Todd project, and we always listen to the Country Hour.
Let's get the latest on the COVID-19 situation. And it's a donut day in the Territory, at least so far. No new cases of COVID-19 have been recorded in the last 24 hours, which is great news. But as always, authorities are warning that we are not out of this yet. About 300 COVID tests from Katherine have been delayed due to those thunderstorms yesterday, which meant they couldn't be flown to Darwin. Those results are expected to come back this afternoon, and you'll, of course, hear about the outcome of that on ABC News and on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory as soon as that comes in. There's been some good news for Katherine and the Big Rivers region. The mask mandate has now lifted, but still no word on when the town will get out of its lockdown. Acting Chief Health Officer Dr. Charles Payne spoke to the media a short time ago.
It's looking very good again today. No cases. We do need to wait for the results of these tests that were done yesterday, and unfortunately the weather did disrupt that. So we expect those results this afternoon. But it's increasingly likely that we have tracked down the main cases in Katherine, particularly in Katherine East. We do expect more cases to emerge from Binjari, which is in lockdown, and we will expect to see more cases emerge in Howard Springs over the next few days. But as to the cases in the community, we're pretty confident that we've tracked those down. We can't be absolutely confident, so that's why we will be deferring our decision-making, and that will depend pending wastewater testing and those further results.
That is Acting Chief Health Officer Dr. Charles Payne. So good news, but hopefully, Katherine, it's not too much longer before you're out of lockdown. It is 20 minutes past 1 o'clock on the Country Hour, which on a Friday means it's time for a tune. Felicity Urquhart and Josh Cunningham on the Country Hour, where it is 24 minutes past one.
This week on Landline, reshaping the system, bringing in seasonal workers from the Pacific and Timor-Leste.
There's been a massive ease of operation for those people out there exploiting labour.
And dynasty dreams in the Red Centre.
Granddad had country down in the Flinders Ranges in the Eyre Peninsula. And he bought this place on a whim, see how he went up here, and yeah, we're still here.
That's Landline, 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
And also on Landline this Sunday, a great story from the Territory by Christy O'Brien about a family-owned cattle company that is expanding. The McKay family from Umbiara Station, right on the South Australian border, runs one of the Australia's largest herds of Red Angus cattle. And in 2019, they made the big decision to buy the neighbouring station of Idrakoura. Angus and Kimberly McKay say the decision to expand coincided with their expanding family.
We knew that we'd have to expand our operation because of our expanding family. We've got three young kids to think about, so you know, we're travelling quite comfortably here on Umbiara, but we knew over the next 10, 20 years we'd have to grow our operation. So it was when it came on the market, we thought we'd better go for it. And yeah. We luckily, we managed to get hold of it. And yeah, no turning back now. So
yeah, I guess for stations around us, Idrakoura's adjoining Umbiara, and for stations to come up neighbouring is not very, it doesn't happen very often. So we kind of, we weren't ready to make that decision, but we knew that this kind of opportunity might not come up again. So we had to...
we had to jump on it.
We had to think quick and make the decision whether to do it or not.
Despite being in one of the worst droughts you'd ever experienced. Yeah.
And expecting a new baby too at the same time. So.
Tell me, how does that change your management? You know, how does adding that to your portfolio change things? How is it different as a station and what you do?
Idrakoura is a big block, but it was very underdeveloped. And we're lucky we came off Umbiara. We had everything. We had 28 sets of working yards and we had one up there. So we're basically starting from scratch trying to develop it. So there's a lifetime of work there. So we've been pulled out of our comfort zone now and we're back to the drawing board again, developing another big block. So
we don't want to get comfortable or anything.
It's a great challenge.
It's a great challenge. We're really enjoying it so far. So
Tell me about the station. Is it different to the country here at all?
Yeah, it is a lot more sandier country. It's got the big thing about it, it's got the Fink River running through it. There's 90 k's of Fink River frontage, and there's permanent water holes, so that's nothing on Unbiar like that at all. So that's the main attraction up there, really. A lot of good fattening country.
And tell me about your family as well.
Yeah, so we have three children. We have Ollie, he's 7, and Millie, she's 3, and Aubrey's 1. So, yeah, that's our little family. It's a very busy household and, yeah, very exciting times having them around.
It sounds like, though, everything you're doing out here is about them, basically.
Yeah, well, if it was just us, we could poke along with Unbiar, but, yeah, we want to give these kids the same opportunities we had when we were younger, so... You know, we've got an obligation to try and pass that on to them. So, yeah, we'll build up our business and hopefully we can do the same for them as what my father did for me. So that's the end game. That's the goal, is to walk away from here and, you know, with successful succession planning in place.
Angus and Kimberly McKay speaking to Christy O'Brien. And you can watch their story this Sunday on Landline.
Share the joy with a feast of gift ideas from ABC Books. In Writing in the Sand, discover how Yothu Yindi and their song Treaty gave voice to a movement. Follow Paralympian Curtis McGrath's journey from Afghanistan to gold in Blood, Sweat and Steel. And in Lawson, explore the rise, ruin and legacy of Australian icon Henry Lawson. Books and audiobooks available in bookshops and online. For more great gift ideas, head to abc.net.au/shop.
Well, that is just about all we have time for on the Country Hour this week. Thank you very much for your company. I've had a text here from Haggis on Old Bino Road, just out of Darwin a little bit. He says he's had 154 mils of rain at his place on Old Bino Road. Haggis, are you still there? You haven't been washed away. They're looking around on the weather radar. There's plenty of activity. The Darwin radar, some pretty isolated storms, and the Bureau said that we could be expecting some severe weather warnings a little bit later today. And it's looking like there's some pretty good rain falling out in Arnhem Land on the Gove Peninsula as well. So we would love to hear your weekend rain reports on Monday's Country Hour. Please keep them coming and have yourself a great weekend. We'll be back with more stories from across the rural parts of the Territory and Australia next week.